Hello everyone, Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks, with me to discuss the Phantom Apprentice, because we had to get Phantom in one more time, is Stephen Tolafield and Thomas Harper. Stephen, Thomas, how are you each doing in that order?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Well.
Yeah, holding up okay in all the quarantine lockdown madness?
Well, my roommate is like house sitting. So I have the place to myself. So I'm abnormally relaxed. Thomas, how you doing, buddy?
I've torn myself away from like my 53rd rewatch of this episode to spend some time with you both. So I'm great. Well, I'll be great when I get back to the episode, but good right now.
In the meantime.
We can... You know, we're lawyers, so we got to focus on that. But my God, from a filmmaking standpoint, this was beautiful.
You know, and I pitched so that the listeners know where I stand and how I went to bat. I pitched that we should just all put our mics in front of the TV and just let this episode be an audio recording of, you know, The Phantom Apprentice. So you just sit and listen to the episode while we kind of gasp in the background. But you know, we'll have a little legal analysis tonight, I guess.
Just a smidge. That's why we're here. But it's stylistically, it's different. And why don't we talk about that after our analysis? But well done to the creative team. So we are back on Mandalore, where the Republic, the Grand Army of the Republic, has helped launch an invasion, whether it's a police action or what. It's still a little tough to describe. But Thomas, you've been to Afghanistan, not on a vacation. And could you tell us, you know, like how you see any comparisons about what the US military did in Afghanistan after, you know, the events of September 11th up through this past year, compared to what's happening in the Clone Wars on Mandalore?
Yeah, this episode, as if there was any question about the scale and degree to which the Republic was going to get involved on Mandalore, that got answered pretty quickly here, as you just see a massive battle raging across Sundari, the capital. And I couldn't help but think of the real world comparison and the legal ramifications that it carried. Many of you, maybe only some of you, may remember back shortly after 9/11 happened. Within about a month or two, we were involved in combat operations in Afghanistan. And interestingly, because the Taliban was the government of Afghanistan at the time, maybe not internationally recognized by every country as such, but the attack or that initial phase of the war on terror, if you will, started out as what they call an international armed conflict. So a state versus a state. And there's an important distinction between what that conflict and what we see, what that conflict morphed into after the Taliban fell and sort of dispersed. And we transitioned into this counterterrorism operation that's extended now for, you know, 15 odd really like 18 odd years. It's crazy to even say that out loud. And now includes operations against the Islamic State, their branch in Afghanistan, and other armed groups that fight there. The difference being it went from an international armed conflict. So in the Star Wars realm, maybe one where the Galactic Republic would fight against Mandalore as, you know, if they were a separatist world, to what they call a non-international armed conflict. And the difference, it's nuanced, but effectively think of a non-international armed conflict like a civil war. There's no real legal distinction between those two terms. A civil war, that term is really meaningless under international law. I mean, there's no special protections or anything that affix to it. But the basic idea is that it's two non-state actors fighting. It's like an internal fight. And here you have Bo-Katan and her house and whatever forces she's been able to assemble in exile versus Death Watch and the syndicates, whatever conglomerate you want to ascribe control of Mandalore to. Neither of those are sovereign powers. I think they both sort of claim that privilege, but even if one were a legitimate national power, like the national ruler of Mandalore, for lack of a better term, it would still be no different than the Taliban internally, or excuse me, the government of Afghanistan internally fighting the Taliban. And the Republic coming in there didn't change it, the nature of that conflict, any more than the U.S. getting involved against the Taliban did. What you see in Afghanistan to this day is this really interesting hybrid where there's no authority under international law for the United States to call Afghanistan an international armed conflict just because we came to fight there. We're not fighting against Afghanistan. We're allied with their government and have been for years. And the important distinction is that in a non-international armed conflict, the full body of the law of war, the law of armed conflict, does not apply. And that's really significant, especially if you're a fighter on the ground, because in a non-international armed conflict, big sort of keystone protections like prisoner of war status or the ability not to, like combatant immunity, where you as a fighter can't be prosecuted for things you do out on the battlefield that are otherwise within the law of war. So like, you know, killing the enemy, those aren't in place. What you've seen in Afghanistan is the U.S. say, okay, well, you know, we're in firm control of this fight, at least until we handed things off to the and stepped out of a combat role. We're still going to let our operations be guided by the principles of the law of armed conflict. And that is, that analysis has changed. But that's what the Republic would probably do here. There's no basis for them to say that they're fighting Mandalore, because that would look bad and probably cause them long-term problems. So the Republic is probably going to come in here, and you see them treat the Mandalorian people with relative kid gloves and say, look, we're here to fight the common enemy here. Your enemy is Death Watch, your enemy is Maul. We're here to help you with that, and in doing so, safeguard the people. And we don't have to, but we'll abide by all these international laws as a showing of good faith and as a way to keep the destruction to a minimum and the loss of innocent life to a minimum. So it's fascinating. I don't know that that ever occurred to the writers as they're like writing all this out, but it's a really, really strong parallel to the situation we're in.
That's really interesting. And I also wondered if you had any insight into what complications the treaties between the Republic and Mandalore would have given rise to, because if I suppose the treaties are only or a violation of a treaty only has legs if the government on the one side of it feels like there's been a breach, but if Bo-Katan is restored as the rightful ruler of Mandalore, she could just say the treaties were honored or something. I really don't know anything about international law, but it strikes me as that sort of intervention that's invited by a foreign power, like how that actually plays out in terms of the international obligations of the countries.
Yeah, and I don't know, and somebody that's out there listening may be aware of like a supplemental guide or something that's escaping me about the treaties that might be in place. But Stephen, you hit it like right on the head, because one thing that is clear from the context is that whatever is in place is longstanding. I think Prime Minister Almec says that the treaties, either him or Obi-Wan say that the treaties that they're breaking are over 100 years old. And I guess this is napkin math in my head in terms of the Star Wars timeline. We know that Mandalore was in a great war with the Jedi at some point before Phantom Menace and whatnot. I don't know if this treaty brought them out of that war, but you do see Bo-Katan sensitive to the political dynamic here. We'll get to the occupation piece a little bit later, but she's like looking, there's this great scene where she's looking down on the Mandalorian people as they're being shepherded by clones, and they're clearly upset. And she turns to Ahsoka, and she's like, this can't go on for much longer. my people won't stand for this. And Stephen, I think that's where it cuts to the heart of your point, that Bo-Katan could have all the goodwill in the world and you know, come back to power and say, look, it was just a necessary evil to have them come in here, and we're not going to break out of this treaty as a result. But if the people aren't behind her, if the people are lingering, if that furor is lingering, it's going to be hard for her to keep the peace. And I think you could see, and that's why it goes back to that comment between Obi-Wan and Bo-Katan in the first episode about getting into another war. I think they know pretty clearly what the ramifications for this would be.
There is so much to unpack with this. Part of me in trying to find historical comparisons and legal justification, you know, stems from the fact that Satine was deposed. So there was a coup against her. So on one level, Maul was never a rightful ruler of Mandalore to begin with. He's a crime lord that seized power by murdering the rightful ruler. So granted, we don't know what their continuity of government plan looks like, but things are going out the window fast where you have crime syndicate running the country, in this case the planet, after murdering their leader. What is this comparable to? Well, one idea that I had, but it's not quite on point, is kind of during, right after World War I, President Wilson sent the U.S. Army into Siberia to try, you know, the only time we invaded Russia, well, or what would be the Soviet Union, trying to throw out the communists. And that's after the Tsar is all murdered. So we you know, we did have a rather bizarre, limited or short term, you know, and, you know, fight in post-Tsarist Russia prior to the formation of the Soviet Union, or rather right at the beginning of it, to try to throw them out of power. That's the only thing that I could think of from U.S. history that's comparable, but we weren't successful. You know, the Soviet Union would spend itself to death after, and also being pathologically afraid of Ronald Reagan and glasnost and perestroika. You know, you can't have a secret society that tries opening up and have it hold together. That said, that's the only thing I could think of that's somewhat comparable. Either of you have any other ideas or thoughts on what we could link this to?
When Mandalore itself is kind of weird, I think it's like a, the best that I could compare it to government wise, it's like a constitutional monarchy. So you have, at least when Satine was in some semblance of power, you had her sharing power with the prime minister, Almec. A vacuum obviously was created when Maul swept into power. But at least at this stage, he doesn't appear to be interested in exercising any sort of power whatsoever. So it's almost like a complete violation of their governmental structure, because Almec now, as the Republic sweeps in, has subsumed all of this power. He still has his title as prime minister, but now he's got that sweet set of Mandalorian armor, and he's, I guess, presumably occupying the throne. It's this weird amalgamation.
And it also strikes me that having a crime syndicate that is successful in just being really violent is not inconsistent with Mandalorian culture. It seems like they're willing to respect, you know, sort of the might makes right theory of whoever is the most powerful and can exert the most influence is the rightful ruler. It strikes me that maybe they don't have a familial succession of governance, unless if there's sort of a challenger that is more successful at wielding martial power. So, you know, it's weird because Satine, her character was so gentle and so thoughtful and mild-mannered. It's hard to think of her as being sort of a warlord, but on the other hand, it seems like their culture is so focused on whoever's the strongest is the one who's going to govern.
Yeah, it is wild and doesn't make sense from a certain point of view, but here we are. Well, let's get into something that's a lot clearer, and that's the torture of Jesse, that I don't remember him from what other episodes we've seen him in before, but Maul is showing some of the Kylo Ren-type powers of the dark side and being able to read minds and pull information out, and was able to sense that Jesse was an older clone and thus had more knowledge about Ahsoka. So he kidnaps Jesse, so we get that kidnapping, and tortures him to get information about Ahsoka. And let's break that down. Steven, do you want to take the torture issue first?
Well, yeah, I was just really struck that I feel like, I didn't do a side-by-side comparison, but the sound effect that they used for the sort of probing, the evil dark side Jedi mind probe was sort of similar to the the one that they used for Kylo Ren in The Force Awakens when he was trying to pry the memories out of Rey, that sort of thunderous rushing wind sound. It's so cool. But yeah, you know, of course, torture is bad. It's unlawful. Here in California, we have a Penal Code Statute Section 206 that prohibits the causing of cruel or extreme pain and suffering for the purpose of extortion or persuasion or for any sadistic purpose, that's the crime of torture, which seems like that mental probe seems very unpleasant at the very least, but people wind up screaming when it's happening to them. So it seems like it's certainly torture. I mean, on the other hand, I guess whether it's a crime is in the eye of the beholder. If Maul is wielding executive authority as the sort of investigator and prosecutor of crimes, and he's involved in what would be an interrogation of a criminal suspect, obviously under the laws of the United States, that sort of physical coercion to share information with the authorities would violate the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And so that would be an unconstitutional interrogation because of the application of force like that. But yeah, Maul is not doing lawful stuff in that scene.
And this is where that talk at the beginning about what type of conflict this is comes into play, because very quickly, even though the clones are losing a lot of men, I mean, Jesse's an ARC trooper. This is one of the best of the best. We've seen him going back to certainly the ARC with Pong Krell, the Jedi general that betrays the clones. You know who he is because he's got that giant Republic tattoo right on his face. It's like the Mike Tyson of the clones. But It's an alarming thing here because he doesn't have that POW status extended to him. Certainly, to some extent, the Republic is going to have like an incentive to treat Syndicate or Death Watch, whatever you want to call this, the Maul's minions now. The Republic has an incentive to treat them right so that they in turn treat Republic captives correct. But this is like the worst case scenario realized here. This is like the Taliban capturing a U.S. soldier. And even though that wide body of POW protections doesn't apply, there's still sort of a baseline layer of protections. You still, no matter what set of laws you're operating under, things like torture are not allowed. And the interesting thing, the fascinating thing about this is there's no physical contact between the two. It's not torture by the traditional sense, like, you know, we're used to perhaps. It's this psychological pain that's inflicted presumably by having your mind invaded. I think it's pretty safe to say, like, I think about the scene where Poe gets interrogated, and also the scene where Cad Bane gets interrogated by like all of the Jedi at once. It's pretty clear that it's a painful experience to have your mind sort of forcibly opened like that. And clearly Jesse is sort of seriously affected by it. You know, he's worn and weary by the time they Maul turns him back over.
Yeah, none of those reclining torture tables for Darth Maul or those torture droids. He goes right for the brain, right?
That's right.
It's gruesome. He's not a good man. And yeah, if you've seen somebody's vacation photos, you know you can be tortured without physical contact. So yes, you can see. Do you see? So let's talk about the prosecution of Maul's followers, because after the battle, we see them getting arrested, or at least captured. You know, we don't have their equivalent of Miranda rights being read, but you have to wonder, like, what are they being arrested for? And like, okay, terrorism, or, you know, gang. And I do think, you know, the definition of a criminal street gang is actually kind of entertaining to look at from federal law. Means an ongoing group, club, organization, or association of five or more members that has as its primary purpose the commission of one or more of the criminal offenses described in subsection B, the members which engage or have been engaged within the past 5 years in a continuing series of events described in the subsection. Looking at the subsection, yeah! I mean, like, these are bad dudes. What they're doing is not okay. It's the RICO bingo game of murder. Yep, got it. Kidnapping, sure. You know, there's spice trading. All right, so we got controlled substance. Maybe money laundering's in there somehow. Like, they really do everything with Crimson Sun. So yeah, there's no shortage of they sound like a gang, but they could be something else. Either of you have thoughts on what else they could be?
Well, this is another interesting interplay about it. Sort of the mirror image of Jesse not getting the benefit of this being some traditional international armed conflict, because the sort of laws and the criminal exposure that you're talking about, something like killing a fellow Mandalorian in battle, traditionally that's something, if this was a typical international conflict, they'd be immune from that. That's a normal, hey, he's an enemy, I shot him. That's fair game under the law of armed conflict. It's just part of war. But because this doesn't have that classification in those, that subset of international law doesn't kick in, I don't know. I think from the Republic standpoint, they're almost certainly going to be treated as detainees or unlawful, unprivileged combatants, similar to how we treat prisoners that are detainees that we take there. They're explicitly not recognized as POWs, but they still enjoy protections based on sort of our interpretation of the rules. But more importantly, Josh, to your point, they could be turned over. I think what the Republic is going to do, because they don't have too many forces there, they're going to hand over custody of those prisoners right back to Bo-Katan, and they're going to be subject to criminal prosecution in Mandalorian courts.
That's the only way that this could be done, because the Republic doesn't want to take Mandalorian prisoners. That's only going to cause bigger problems down the road.
That's not really a spoil of war.
No, it's not. It's like, oh, we get these jerks? Awesome. Thanks. Why don't you guys deal with Saxon and all the other clowns?
I'd confiscate the armor and just put that like on a mannequin back in my barracks as a clone trooper, because that would be pretty cool. Or like maybe just like Rook Cast's helmet or something like that. No need to harm them. You just take their stuff. One of those cool gauntlet shields. I don't know.
Yes, yes. Some things that we can see in Mandalorian eventually. So yes. Now we do get to the prison that they have, and they put the Prime Minister, Maul's henchman, Almec, and there's custodial interrogation, and then the dude gets murdered. So, Stephen, do you want to enlighten us about the interrogation issues with him?
Yeah, it's really an unfortunate chain of events for poor Almec there. He's, you know, down in his luck in prison being interrogated, and then he gets sniped by Gar Saxon. It's a bad day for poor Prime Minister Almec. But like I mentioned before, if when you're being interrogated by the authorities, when they're asking you for information, especially when you're in custody, you have under the U.S. Constitution all sorts of criminal protections. And one of the key ones, of course, is the right to not self-incriminate, and also the right to an attorney that was identified and codified by the Supreme Court in Miranda versus Arizona. And so he's obviously being interrogated without access to an attorney. It's not clear that he asked for one or that he waived his right to an attorney. But then of course, Ahsoka kicks everything up a notch by threatening him when he didn't share who Maul had a vision of with Bo-Katan's fists. And Bo-Katan starts to move towards Almec as if she's going to pummel the information out of him. And of course, that sort of physical coercion, as we said, in a custodial situation like this, is squarely prohibited by the 14th Amendment's protections of due process. So it's funny that there's that contrast in the episode between the scene immediately before, I think, is when Maul interrogates Jesse, and then they cut to the prison where Ahsoka is interrogating Almec. And on the one hand, they're both using very coercive, very frankly unlawful methods of interrogation, but the dark side's method is to kind of invade people's minds, while the light side's method is to just kind of beat it out of people, which seems to me maybe a little more honest, maybe more Jedi-like, but still would be unlawful in the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, you can't beat people. Sure, it might be therapeutic in this case, but
ineffective, I guess. But yeah, it's not lawful.
It's not lawful. And at some point he would just say anything. On the flip side, the best way to get him to talk and out Maul is for somebody to try to murder him from Maul's orders. That generally should get the witness very, very talkative. So let's just be clear, that's murder. Absolutely.
What's interesting, the Ahsoka sort of graduated from, oh gosh, I forget which episode it was, but there was a past episode where Nuke Gunray, the Trade Federation leader, was in custody, in Republic custody, and they're trying to figure out details of his latest plot, and he's obviously clamming up, and Ahsoka goes right at him and puts her lightsaber to his throat, and Ahsoka's probably like 13 or 14 at this point, has to get pulled off him. At least she's graduated to outsourcing that sort of thing now.
Having her thugs, although I hesitate to call Bo-Katan a thug, she's awesome. But yeah, having someone who's more heavily armored and better, like, protected fists, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. But still, you... Yeah, the concept of you don't torture prisoners to get them to talk. It's one thing if there's the ticking time bomb. That's like the one exception. And we did see that this season with the kind of a thermal nuclear device that needed to be shut down in order to get Anakin get very hands-on and dirty. But that's not quite the situation here. There doesn't seem to be that threat to life. It's we want to catch him so he can't leave. That's not the same. Now let's talk about the occupation. And, Thomas, you raised that they turn into an occupying army. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, precisely... one of the many reasons that Obi-Wan was a little hesitant to just jump on board with Ahsoka's request here and Bo-Katan's request is exactly this. I think he saw it as a three-dimensional issue. This wasn't as simple as going in and snapping Maul up and you know, helping in a brief skirmish and getting out of there. He knew that this was going to have a ripple effect. And you see that towards the end of the episode, as I mentioned earlier, that great shot where the Mandalorian people are kind of going across that gangway and are clearly upset as the clones lead them to a shelter area. And Bo-Katan says that this just can't continue for much longer. The people won't stand for it. And very quickly, as the resistance from the syndicate forces fell, you see the 501st become an occupying army. And it doesn't take a whole lot to be an occupying army legal-wise, but it does trigger a set of responsibilities and things that can get you entangled in a country, or in this case, on a world, for a lot longer than you intend to be, because you owe certain duties to the people. You have to offer protection to the people to the extent that the government cannot provide them. To the extent that the government can't do other services like, the prosecution of criminal acts and things like that, the military has to get involved in providing those protections. You know, that might look something like a military court stood up in the vacuum of, civil courts that have become unoccupied or unable to function. People have a right to resist the occupation. I mean, there's a recognized international right to fight back against this sort of thing, which is something that I think Bo-Katan has her finger squarely on the pulse of. She realizes that this is a very fragile situation. And, you've got to be very careful even beyond the legal requirements in terms of the treatment of the people, because the moment that you as the occupying army lose that support and are seen as, equal to or worse than the enemy that you replaced, it becomes a very fragile political situation. And oftentimes that's that concern, that political, non-legal concern is right up there with the other priorities that you're dealing with.
Yeah, nothing good comes from an occupying army. Get in, get out. So there's...
And they don't even have an army. Remember, this is a subset of the 501st. This is, they sent several Star Destroyers, but they split the 501st. And, at best, we're talking a battalion or two of clones. Enough to fight back the Mandalorians and whatnot, but not enough to hold Mandalore, especially if there becomes a larger uprising of the people there.
Yeah. Well, with the legal analysis aside, let's nerd out. The cinematic feel of this was palpable. The cold open, just starting with a fight, there's like no music, no crawl, no wartime correspondent coverage. It's Ahsoka versus Maul surrounded with lightsabers ablaze. I mean, just brilliant. And jumping ahead, the fight between Ahsoka and Maul was beautiful to see, because of their very different fighting styles. In the movies we get, lightsaber versus lightsaber. We haven't seen the double hilt lightsaber against a dual wielder before. And that was cool, because Ahsoka has a very specific fighting style. Both are acrobatic. And that was just fun to watch as a fan, because we haven't seen that in live action. And maybe, the only thing that I think of that equally blew my mind was in Rebels, the fight with the Grand Inquisitor, using Ezra's lightsaber blaster combo with Kanan and running around, like that was one of the best lightsaber fights, you know, that had been done in this, in all of Star Wars. This is equally special because of how they fight and the weapons that they're using. Stephen, you're smiling and nodding. What was your reactions to this?
I agree that fight in the season, was it the season finale of season one of Rebels between Kanan and the Grand Inquisitor, was so thrilling and so fun to watch, and so emotional too, because you know, Kanan, you know, the Inquisitor appears to kill Ezra, and Kanan says something like, "That was a mistake," and the Grand Inquisitor taunts him, and he says, and Kanan says, "Well, now I have nothing left to fear," and like he grabs Ezra's lightsaber, and he has two lightsabers. It's so good. So seeing that echoed in this episode was amazing, and also I was just so impressed with the motion capture angle of it. It looked so good, and of course the fact that Ray Park did the motion capture for it, and the woman who did Ahsoka's, Lauren Mary Kim, looked amazing. It looked so good, and it was just thrilling every second of it, and I hope that we see more of that in the coming episodes.
That may have been my, I would say, top three favorite lightsaber fights of film or TV series. It was just incredible. And Stephen, your bit about the parallel, the moment where Maul loses it and is falling and Ahsoka stops him was such a great parallel to the Inquisitor's death, where, you know, he carried through with it and his you know, he's okay with it because he's got a greater fear there, whether it's Vader or Emperor Palpatine. And that's reflected here. All Maul, the only bit of fear that we've ever seen Maul outwardly reflect is to Palpatine, to Sidious. And that was such a great aspect of his character through this. That line, like, you're all going to burn, we're all going to die, just like made my hair stand on end.
I didn't really draw that connection before, but you're so right. The only thing that the Inquisitors fear is Darth Vader, and it's like Darth Maul, the whole reason for the whole Siege of Mandalore, the whole war, was so that Maul could lure Anakin to Mandalore so he could kill him, because he's so afraid of what he could become. And I'm reminded of the video game Fallen Order, where Trilla is sort of refers to sort of the scariest thing was, and it was like Darth Vader as he comes over the rise behind her while she's incapacitated. That's amazing that all the Inquisitors, all the Darksiders, just live in fear of Darth Vader.
Yeah. I think the thing that stood out to me the most, and it's only going to be ratcheted up from here, is this overwhelming sense of dread that we're, other than Maul, we as the viewers are the only ones that know what's coming and what's happening in the background. When you see Obi-Wan talking to Ahsoka and talking about Dooku's death and sort of still processing that, and his call to Utapau to chase down General Grievous. I mean, the Revenge of the Sith was playing in my mind as I watched this, and I wanted to like bang on my TV screen and yell at them both to just run away. But you know, it's only going to increase because we know where the timeline is going, and it's going to be brutal to watch what I assume will be Order 66 happen on screen. But this sense of dread is just palpable. It's such a powerful undercurrent.
And the writers did a great job too, because it could be, you know, it's a very thin line to walk between when the audience knows what's going to happen, it could be just really boring and not interesting. But when they're leveraging this dread so effectively to make us all, we know what's going to happen, but that's only contributing to the sense of drama and scale. And I think it's so, so well done. And I'm simultaneously dreading and can't wait for the next two episodes of the arc.
Well, they subverted expectations, because people would expect Maul to get away. and Ahsoka captured him without her lightsabers. I know, granted, she had backup, you know, that they, you know, the cavalry got there in time, but she had him hanging in midair, you know, so the alternative was like, I'm going to put you back up here, but he's lost his lightsaber. Granted, hers have both fallen as well, so maybe that's how she's going to get white ones later. maybe they survived the fall. I don't know. But again, you expect him to get away because that's what we've seen. Like, we know that the bad guys win at the end of Revenge of the Sith. They captured him. What's going to happen next? And how does all of this lead to Order 66? And what ultimately will happen in Revenge of the Sith? But it does raise interesting questions of, will Kenobi and Ahsoka talk again? And what will that be like if it happens post Anakin's turn to the dark side? And, you know, thinking to Rebels, she didn't know Vader was Anakin. So will she learn that he turned bad and murdered younglings? Because I'm sure that will not end well with her. And she also has absolute faith in Anakin, which also has to be a massive heartbreak, because she says, like, you don't know, you know, Anakin. And he's just like, oh, that's so horrible for you to say that, because you... But again, that's also my view, that the animated Anakin Skywalker is more likable and believable than the live action. And that's just from storytelling and direction, not because of the actor.
I think it'd be very poignant if the last that she sees of Obi-Wan is his emergency call to the Jedi, if she's able to receive that call and either hurriedly make preparations or have that be the moment where she realizes she has to go into her own version of exile. Sort of like, you know, when you in the first season of Rebels, when Ezra is messing with Kanan's holocron and opens it up, and you see that sort of the vestige of him. I think that would be a brutal emotional moment, but a really good one.
Yeah, we've seen that message received a number of times, but we've never actually seen Obi-Wan broadcast it or record it. Because we saw, like we said, we saw it in Rebels, and it showed up in Fallen Order too. So yeah, it's made a couple appearances. It'd be interesting if we finally see Obi-Wan make it to the Jedi Temple to reverse the beacon to send people into hiding as opposed to calling them back.
We will soon find out. And I'm like, it'll be interesting to see how much they cross into Revenge of the Sith, because we do see them, Yoda and Kenobi, go to the temple. And, you know, they see the recording of Anakin slaughtering children. You know, like, it has to be after that. So while Yoda goes to confront Palpatine, you know, Kenobi either records and gets away, or something along those lines has to happen. But the thing that I've wondered about, and this is a bigger Star Wars issue. In the original Star Wars, you know, there's the, no, it's more Empire, where Kenobi refers to Darth Vader being more machine than man. Did Kenobi know Anakin survived Mustafar? And I don't know the answer to that. And if he did learn that Darth Vader was on the rampage in the galaxy, how did he learn that? Because it's not like he's getting newspapers, and it's not like Bale is dropping off supplies occasionally. Like, they have to stay apart in order to not have any connection. So I'm curious to see, or is it just by using the Force he's able to determine that? So I wonder.
That's a good question. I wonder if Ahsoka gave him a first-hand account at some point. because the timeline works, right? Because yeah. Obi-Wan's just on Tatooine, and Ahsoka has the duel in Rebels, and so maybe at some point they connect. I don't know.
Yeah, she goes to Tatooine and finds him. Like, again, I'd be cool with that.
I would crashing be, on his couch.
Yeah, I'd be very cool with the Kenobi live action show having Ahsoka pop in. Like, that would be, you know, Steven, your reaction's adorable. Thomas, you're glowing. So, yeah.
Full squee. Yes, that would be amazing.
It's like as we both all fanboy flail at that idea. But, yeah, like, that would be pretty sweet if we actually saw that happen. So that would probably be at the 15-year mark when it's about that time in Rebels. Because that's just, it's like 5 to 4 years before Battle of Yavin. So did she go visit? And how Alec Guinnessy can Ewan McGregor look? I'm sure he's up for the challenge. So like he's you know, those double sons do double the aging, but yeah, I'm sure he can do it. So
my last comment is just reveling in how amazing it is that considering 12 years ago, the sort of flack that Ahsoka took after her, you know, her initial appearance in the Clone Wars movie, and people were just throwing their arms up in exasperation, like, well, how could Anakin have a Padawan, and she's annoying and this and that. And now we rightly can't get enough of her. And, you know, I genuinely hope that she's plugged in and has plenty more stories to tell so that I can drink that up. It's just an amazing path that character has walked. All born from Lucas being like, yeah, Anakin's got a Padawan.
It is. A lot of 13-year-olds are obnoxious. It's a phase. They get over it. They turn into wonderful adults. And, you know, Ahsoka falls into that category of, like, we saw her as a kid. The character is now matured and is one of the best Star Wars characters, in my opinion, from a storytelling perspective. And especially what we see, what she becomes by the time of Rebels. And how they sidelined her and were able to bring her back without killing her. So it's stuff like that. So with that, any other thoughts for the good of the order?
So, is it Friday yet? Have we talked long enough that we've killed all the time until Friday?
No, and I hope not. There's a lot of work to do this week, so it's it's gonna be a busy work week, boys. It's gonna be a busy work week. And well, with that said, everyone, thank you for tuning in. Stay safe. Stay at home. Wear a mask correctly. I've seen. I went to the grocery store, all these people who had their noses exposed. It's not how a mask works. Anyway, stay safe, and hopefully we'll see you at Celebration, but if we don't, we'll be virtual. Everyone, take care.